College, currently of Spencer, West Virginia. Frank, would you tell me where you were born?
Born in Bluefield. Bluefield, West Virginia.
And in what year, if you don't mind?
1928. I'm getting to be an oldie.
Was culture part of your growing up? I know I just spoke to Jane, your wife, briefly, and she said that she wasn't really aware of her culture until later on, until she met you. And then what she had known kind of clicked in, but she didn't really have an awareness of it when she was growing up. What kinds of traditions were you exposed to, and at what point were you aware that they were, you know, something out of the ordinary or different from what a lot of people experience?
Well, I grew up in a musical family, and the music was the first thing I learned. My grandfather got me started. He lived with us, and he played fiddle and banjo. And my dad, when I was small, made me two little homemade instruments. I still have them. I made a homemade banjo. That's the five string, of course, and I learned to play it when I was about seven. And then the fiddle was more or less a toy. And by the time I started really learning tunes on the fiddle, I was about nine. So I switched over to the ordinary size, the regular size fiddle. I could hold it, you see. So I got a little homemade fiddle. Didn't have that much to do with it. But anyway, I have those instruments. So I really got started with some music. I wasn't aware until later that our language was a little different from outsiders. I wasn't aware of certain customs that were different.
Now, when you say outsiders, you mean outside your county, outside West Virginia, outside your family?
I was really thinking outside of an area of West Virginia and Virginia. But you had to go good ways to see the difference. You'd have to go to Ohio or Pennsylvania or D.C. or something, because if you went over into Kentucky and Virginia, Southwest Virginia, East Tennessee, or Western North Carolina, there wasn't that much difference. Some speech differences, but generally it's the same culture. And later on, I was aware that this was isolation, you see. The radio hadn't made that much of a dent on my folks, and the TV hadn't come out yet. I mean, nobody had a television. And we had very poor roads. I remember when there wasn't a decent road to take a T-model Ford over. Absolutely not fit to drive over. So we still were isolated, except for the infernal radio. And then later on, of course, I got interested in the early history, not only West Virginia history, but pioneer history, and where the people came from in the first place before they got to America. And that led to the study of the Scottish stuff. And of course, this week is my purpose is to talk about Scottish influence on West Virginia. And you've looked at phone books, you'll see any phone book in West Virginia, you'll find scads of Mac names. And of course, some of those are Irish. Then you'll find the names that are Scottish that are not Mac, like Campbell and Shaw and Farquharson, on and on. And then you have to really start digging. You have to get special books. The ordinary school books, history book, will not tell West Virginians about themselves. They will give a history of West Virginia, Virginia, and the nation, but they will not tell about these little differences of our culture. So I had to delve into special books. I've ordered many, I've spent a fortune on books, and writing to libraries and going to libraries that have better selections. Then, of course, talking to people that are interested in this subject, you see. You don't find too many people interested in that, but like Jane mentioned, Dr. Patrick Gaynor and Dr. Simpkins at Marshall and a few others, they were interested back when I was a youngster, maybe before my time. So they did collecting songs, for instance. And you refer to these older folks, people who worked in, you can learn a lot from them, of course. Of course, the best source was my grandparents and older people. Mm-hmm. They're close kin cousins, great aunts and great uncles. And what they remember, the great grandparents were already gone. And anybody that's older,
right.
Don't have to be in the family. Any old person, you know, especially if they're a musician or singer.
What were they able to tell you? Who emigrated when? From what area of Scotland would people end up in West Virginia? Was there? I know sometimes in immigrations it's a certain area that settles in a certain area, but not always.
They're not too, weren't too good on that after a little ways back. Then you read about the big migration, who they landed to maybe up in Pennsylvania, Delaware, Newcastle, in that Upper Bay area, you know. And they settled in Pennsylvania, then the great migration down the Valley of Virginia. That was important. Down the valley and then turn west. They turned right, you see, and come into what's now West Virginia, across the mountains. And you can pretty well date some of these movements, but you can't date a family because they've lost all their records. They never were interested in keeping any history. So a lot of it becomes just an educated guess about, like when the Campbells settled, you know. The Campbells, Lynchburg is the county seat of Campbell County, Virginia. Well, evidently there was Campbells around there that wouldn't name the county Campbell County. But it's hard to figure when the Campbells came in there, you know. We know it's early, probably pre-Revolution. Then when the Scots landed in North Carolina after the 45, they landed down there at the mouth of the Cape Fear near Wilmington. Well, they came on up into North Carolina. And somewhere along the line, some of them moved north into Virginia and then came, well, they made a left turn and came over into what's now West Virginia. But I can't date that. I don't know individual family histories, so I can't tell you when they came in, you see, except it's early. Before West Virginia, still Western Virginia, or West Augusta, hence the name of this festival, you see.
Is there a way through the tunes that have been carried down to kind of date it using the music?
I don't know about dates, but that's the thing that gave me the clue. After I became familiar with pipe music and Scottish music, it suddenly struck me. I said, hey, these fiddlers are playing Scottish tunes and variations and combinations of maybe one tune and have two or three other tunes mixed up with it, you know. And they didn't realize it was pipe music, you see. They'd have a name, maybe have the same name, but usually a different name or no name at all, see. So they didn't realize the connection. They were playing, this was handed down, generation to generation, but they had no idea of the roots of it. That's what made me get interested in the Scottish music, really. And of course, where I was isolated as far as learning the pipes was a terrible job. I had no help whatsoever. You couldn't buy a record, a phonograph record of pipe music. You couldn't find pipes. You couldn't find reeds. You couldn't find a piper. You couldn't find anything in books on it except they mention it. You look up Scotland, you know, the Scots play the bagpipes and on to some other subject. So, you know, it was just from the bottom. I really started from scratch without any help whatsoever.
Where did you come? How old were you when you came across your first set of bagpipes, and how did you come across them?
Oh, I was up in my teens, late 40s, and I can't remember exactly how I found out, a man named John Adamson, who lived in a suburb of Boston, Massachusetts. I can't remember the name of the place now. It's probably in Boston now, but it was another address. Made pipes. And I think the way I found out about it, I went to a movie, and it was a short subject. Movies used to have a lot of things after the movie, the serial, the previews, the comedy, the cartoon, the news, and short subjects, you know. And if I remember right, they had an article, a brief article on John Adamson, only pipe maker in the U.S. of A., you see. And I really don't remember how I got the address. Unless they said it, don't think they said anything but the town. Anyway, I got in touch with him. Can't remember how. And I bodaciously, there's a good term, ordered a set of pipes. And I wanted Adams, but he wasn't making them anymore. They had two or three sets left or something, and the family wanted to keep them. I dealt with his daughter, believe it or not. Anyway, I bought a set, and that was the beginning. And I had to start, I had to find me some books, and I had to find me a piper. I had to find some records, so it was a long, hard road. But I finally got started. And I'm still learning and working on it. Mm-hmm. We're talking about nearly 40 years.
Did you ever find anyone else in the area who played the pipes who was out of the tradition as well?
Don't think so. The Elkins Band here was formed in 1948. But I don't think there's any family connections. Dave Brown was an important founder, he and another fellow. And he imported a Scotsman from Pennsylvania to get his pipers started with the practice chanter in the basics. Mm-hmm. So apparently there's no Elkins tradition. Hmm.
Now, the tunes that you learned from your grandfather, and you realized that it occurred to you that they must have Scottish roots, when you started to play the bagpipes, did you play those variant tunes that you learned, or did you learn the traditional method of Scottish playing?
No, it's, you play them only one way to be, I mean, you have to learn the basics or you're not playing correctly. So a lot of tunes on the fiddle could not be played on the pipes because it has only 9 notes. So if the tune was in that range, you could play the fiddle tune as a piper. And you must remember, fiddlers bar from pipers, but pipers also bar from fiddlers. So if you play a tune beyond that range, you have to back up or go down and hit the other note. You hit me, make the same note, but it might be an octave lower or an octave higher, depending on what the tune is, see. Then we had, there's some Scots came over later, Bill Smart and Huntington, for instance, came to this country from Dundee in 1921 or 22, went to work for the CNO. So he got a small band started. And he's trained, I expect a half a dozen pipers. And, but that's late, see, that's not a West Virginia connection. Right. That's an immigrant connection.
Right.
Have you taught anyone to play the pipes?
I've taught a few. I don't know what I could remember or not. I got Mike Metter started, didn't I?
Don
Ransfield. Don Ransfield. I got George Baldero started.
Really?
I really didn't do anything but give him confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were too far apart, you see, to work with him.
Shooting techniques.
Anyway, I kind of got him started. Yeah. I don't want to take credit for something like it, and I didn't really do it, you know.
Do you feel that there may be a West Virginia tradition of bagpiping coming out of you, or do you adhere so closely to the style that you learn? Because
if anybody learns from me, they're going to have it's going to be a style.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that, but that's a fact.
Yeah.
Is that because of the fiddle music you play too? That just
whatever it's my idea of how it ought to be.
Yeah.
You know, because I found it in books written incorrectly. See, so I'm not going to teach somebody that version.
Right.
Even other pipers will admit it's incorrect. Scottish piper, you see. So I know. Then I'm on the right track.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you.
Just trying to think, is there anything else?
Just give me a couple biographical. What have you worked at during your life?
A couple of what biographical?
Yeah, I mean. What have you done for a living, you know?
Oh, I used to work as a surveyor, mm-hmm. a civil engineer, but I haven't done that for quite a while. I'm semi-retired, you might say. I teach music. I teach fiddle, banjo, and
mm-hmm.
not much piping, and dulcimer.
Right.
Plucked and hammered dulcimer. I don't do that much anymore. And the only connection I have with Scotland is the McGregors, the only clan I can find, and that's on my mother's side, and she was from Tennessee. So somewhere back in the 1700s, or it could have been earlier, these McGregors settled in Tennessee or North Carolina then, depending on the date. Tennessee was cut out of North Carolina. And I've traced back and found some of the family, some of the tombstones. I have not found out how many, or where they moved from into Tennessee, or when they came to America, or if they were musicians. I'm up against a stone wall, and as of right now, I can't tell you anything about them to amount to.
Have you? Do you have any children that you've passed your music on to?
No, I have no children. These have been mostly people out of my family that have learned. Been scared of them too, especially on the fiddle and banjo. And dulcimer, maybe.
Yeah.
And a few on the pipes.
When you say your family was musical, were they say, musicians of the community who would play for dances and parties? Or?
Yeah, but they were not well known. This was not a thing that was considered an art form or a cultural thing, you see. It was common for families then to have musicians, and they'd get together, they'd have sessions at home, or a dance maybe at the country club, or the Legion Hall, or the VFW Hall, or the University Club, or Elks, Eagles, you know, whatever kind of an organization, they'd have these big square dances and round dances. But the real good stuff was around home, when you'd have a corn shucking, or a bean stringing, or you know, hog killing, or you know, whatever kind of a session, and then everybody would get with it, and it would go on. Sometimes, if it was Saturday night, Friday night or Saturday night, it would go on all night. You know, you'd be playing when the sun come up the next morning. People, they'd really get in gear about midnight or one, and then God knows what would happen. It was a real ceilidh, a real session. I said ceilidh when they didn't even know the word. That's a Gaelic word for jam session. They'd be totally unfamiliar with that. See, the language is lost. They spoke Elizabethan English. That's what I'm talking to you now, you see. It's not school English. So they were totally unaware of any of that stuff. But they had a great time playing and dancing and singing.
Was there any kind of conscious teaching, or was it just while they're jamming, you get in there with your fiddle and try to pick out something?
No formal training, no written music. You learned it by listening. You get the tune in your head. You might hum or whistle a tune for 2-3 days before you could get it on the fiddle. And my style was to copy other fiddlers, you know, listen and watch. And some tunes I'd pick up almost immediately, and others would take 2 or 3 days, and some might take 6 months. Depending on how hard you worked and how complicated the tune was, you know. But these people, it all came down by air, you see. Music by air, and nobody really thought about it. Yeah, my boy plays, you know. He learned from me. Or so-and-so learned from Uncle Ike, and or Grandpa so-and-so, and he managed to take it on. Unfortunately, I think that's stopped now. The television and things have about to wipe that out.
Yeah.
But really, it's the only way to keep it going, you see.
Yeah.
You don't need written music. These Scots didn't have, the pipers, for instance, didn't have written music until fairly late. It was all oral tradition. You chanted the tune, you talked it, you sang it with the old language. And every word, every syllable, every sound meant a note or a grace note or an inflection or a had something to do with the tune, so you learned it the best way. You see, that's the only way, as far as I'm concerned.
Are there any tunes that you're still adding to your own personal repertoire, or do you pretty much recycle what you've learned?
Oh, I learn tunes every now and then from a band or a record, you know, or a tape, you know. And then, of course, you have to tell your students that this is not West Virginia tune. You know, I learned this from Sean Reed from County Clare, West Ireland, or something like that. You know, it's a great tune, but it's not Appalachian. It's a pity it didn't come over and be one, you know. So you have to keep them separated. Then you don't want to get too far off the track. You'd be neglecting your own music. But in central West Virginia now, there's more fiddlers than there are down where I lived, I think. So I'm not too far away from people like Ernie Carpenter and Harvey Sampson. Well, Wilson's there, yeah. Central West Virginia still got a bunch of the old traditional people who learn from someone else without being influenced by radio. That's traditional, you see. Of course, you pick up a tune on the radio once in a while.
Yeah, but it's not the same oral tradition.
It's not traditional West Virginia, no. Not unless there's some West Virginian performing somewhere.
I think just one last point. You said the only thing you had was the radio. Was there anything that you picked up from country music off the radio?
I don't think so. Maybe Raggedy Ann or some tune like that would be this side of 1900. See, I try to keep all my stuff prior to 1900. So that cuts out a lot of radio stuff. I didn't hear anything on the radio any good except Grand Ole Opry and the Chicago station and the Cincinnati station. They'd have a supper time frolic or some such thing.
Yeah, what about WWVA, the Barnyard? Or
too modern.
No, too modern.
Yeah, plumb out of the field.
Okay.
But see, these other stations like Chicago and Cincinnati wouldn't have locals. These people would be from Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia, doing the old-time stuff. But you would hear a new tune now and then, or a different group, you see. The old-timers, old musicians learned a long time ago. I don't know if the programs are still on.
Grand Ole Opry's still on, but I think
that's... Oh, my God, yes, but it's...
It's not the same. Not the same.
It's totally changed. It was ruined about 1938, as far as I'm concerned.
What changed at that time?
The fiddle and the banjo became background, or not at all. It tended to go toward pianos and guitar. Well, guitars took over, and then there was pianos and drums and electric instruments and... Mostly vocal. It got to be country songs, or I don't really know how you describe them. And the big hit musicians, you know, like Hank Williams and all this, and it was a totally different ball game. I could see no traditional music whatsoever. Grand Ole Opry. And Wheeling was one of the worst stations I ever listened to. I just turned it off, you know. I had absolutely nothing there that I wanted to hear, even in the early days.
Yeah. It's more so
it was
now.
Swing, you know, it was already swing music and blues and ragtime, and, which I think comes from jazz violin or something, you know. So it, in other words, it had gone completely from old time to nothing else.
Right.
So I wasn't interested.
Right. Okay.
Well, thanks very much, Frank. I appreciate your time.
Thanks. You can tell them the story.
It's really not very complicated.
Right.
You know, he was one of these people.
Right. I'm talking to Jane George, Frank George's wife, and she's going to tell me the first time Frank ever heard the pipes play.
Well, he told me that the first time he ever heard the pipes was a traveling show. Bluefield had a lot of this kind of thing. Chautauquas and the Red Path. Series of things that came around, and I don't know which one it was, but I think he told me that his grandpa took him to all these, you know, and lo and behold, there was a piper, and it really appealed to him. It spoke to him right quick, and I don't know how old he was. He was just a little boy.
Yeah. And so he
was 14 when he ordered the pipes.
Yeah.
And his mother told me that. Frank, how old were you when you heard that traveling piper, the first one?
Which?
You told me about the first pipe you ever heard.
Lipton Tea Man came through town. I used to think it was Sir Arthur Lipton, and I found out he was too old and infirm, but it was an agent, a salesman for Lipton Tea. brought a piper down to the, near the railway station in Bluefield. I happened to be in town when I heard the thing playing, and I broke and run just like a deer to get to it, and of course stayed there as long as he played. I'd still be there if he was playing. That's my first sound of it.
Thank you.
I was almost right about that.
Yeah.
And you grew up where in West Virginia?
I grew up in the Ohio River Valley. I didn't live along the river, but it was a feeder stream, you know. And in lower altitudes, I would say that I was a hill child, whereas Frank grew up in the mountains in the high elevations. And there's a lot of cultural differences in this state because of geographical location. And the part of the state I grew up in was the last that was settled. Well, maybe with the possible exception of some of the southwestern part. And there was a backward migration from Kentucky and Ohio into this area, and also from the northern parts of the state down into it about the time right preceding the Civil War. And that's, it's Roane and Clay and Calhoun counties, just one county removed from the Ohio River. And so I was a hill child, and we had all this, we had a lot of words and languages and customs that were Scottish, but I never knew that. I mean, you took it for granted. I think that most West Virginia people had what our language lady, we have a woman here who made a study of the language, she called, she used the term cultural amnesia. I think we had cultural amnesia. We just took everything for granted, you know. And then after I met Frank, and heard the pipes, and see, nobody was playing them except the Elkins Highlanders. And a few, Mr. Smart had had the band way back there, but it wasn't active very long, or very didn't travel hardly any. And Frank was doing solo piping at Glenville at the West Virginia Folk Festival, and then he came to the Art and Craft Fair at Cedar Lakes, and that's where I first heard him.
When was that?
1966. All of this began, this cultural revival in the mountains, about the year West Virginia Centennial Celebration was held, which was 1963. And we worked on folklore and trying to get out the folk craftsmen, the folk musicians, and all these. And very few people had been doing anything about that before that. Right. There was a professor, first at Glenville, then at West Virginia University, who did a lot in extension classes. And many of us began to see a light about it through his classes, and his name is Dr. Patrick Gaynor, and I think we need to give him an awful lot of credit for what's happened. And then I went for my master's degree at Marshall University, I found the man who started the first Appalachian culture class in America, and that's Dr. Norman Simpkins. He's still living, whereas Dr. Gaynor's passed away. But Dr. Simpkins is a real, real personable individual and an authority on Appalachian people. And he will refer to them as Celtic and try to explain to you who the Scotch-Irish are and things like that. He gets them over to America and tells you about the backgrounds of it from Scotland.
Tell me a little about the Mountain Heritage Program that you set up and what line of work you were involved in. And when you met Frank, maybe too many questions at once, were you involved in that kind of work at that time when you met him?
I was a recreation worker when I met Frank, public recreation for Kanawha County. That was about the centennial year and a few years after. And then, actually, I had access to a lot of youth. I was working in youth work. That's the whole thing I did professionally. And church youth, then public recreation, and then I worked with the Arts and Crafts Division at the Department of Commerce in developing the folk crafts and that part of our culture after it came to be a government-sponsored program. And then, last of all, I worked for West Virginia University Extension Service. Well, when I met Frank, it was as if the amnesia was certainly suddenly flooded with light. Somebody turned on a light in my mind. My gosh, here I am. And, you know, I'd always been told, as nearly everybody had, that everything was English. We were English stock, and all our customs and everything came from the British Isles, which was true, except which part of it. And hardly anyone took it a step farther back from British to, or English to Scotland or Ireland or Wales. And all three were very, very much a part of the scene in West Virginia. Because, of course, southern West Virginia, where the coal mines are, my goodness, it's almost predominantly Welsh. And we haven't even started on that yet. But we've made an awfully good start this week here with this Scottish Week, I think. It's made an impact. Now, what we did, when I first came into Extension, was about the same time all this folk revival was beginning. And I used to be involved in public recreation with teaching songs and teaching folk dances. And even when I was a child, I loved those things. And I can remember the words to a lot of the old ballads and even the fiddle tunes just because I heard them over and over and over. Same stations he was talking about and things like that. Nobody in my family played, well, take it back. My immediate family didn't play music, but in my county, some of the good musicians were the Taylors, and I was a Taylor. And I'd always been told that was an English name, and then I found out it was really not. It was Scottish, and it belonged to the... It was a sept of the Clan Cameron. So it occurred to me that if this was good for me to know, and if it was interesting for me to know, it would be for a lot of other people too. And we had access to many youth through Cooperative Extension 4-H programs. And we really organized a program that we called the Mountain Heritage Series. And it was totally funded in the beginning by the Arts and Humanities Council, both on the state level and the federal level. And what we did was write up a program. And we did a demonstration weekend. We got the money together for a demonstration weekend. And we got people in, like from Pittsburgh and hither and yon. If we had Dr. Gaynor alive then, and he taught the folk song segment of it. And we did a lot of research. But we got a Highland dancer down there to show them some of the things that had happened that they didn't know about. And we took a select group of kids. We could only take so many because of space limitations. And what we did was build an awareness in them of their cultural, the rich culture behind them. And it was such a hit that it continued. It was funded by the National Endowment of the Arts as the only program for a select program for that year. And it extended into the next 2 years. And these kids went scot-free to these programs. And they were...
No pun intended.
But. No. And we tried to get very select staff to give them accurate information. And all we could do was build awareness. But I could list for you dozens of young people who picked up on that and went on their own to become a very special craftsman or a very special musician. Some of them played dulcimers or made them. Many, many of them learned traditional dancing, and they learned that it wasn't an English country dance, it was a Scottish country dance, or an Irish jig, or something else, and many of them made costumes. I myself decided that, because it was so beautiful, and because Frank played the bagpipes, and we had the accompaniment, that I would train a Highland dance group, and I did this in every county I worked in. I worked in five in West Virginia before I retired. We've had Highland dancers in every county, and we approached it differently from what it is done in most places here, because most people do it as they teach Highland dancing for competition and for precision and polish. Well, in the old days in Scotland, they didn't do that. Every district danced it in their own way, and it was for pleasure and self-recreation, etc. Self-expression, yes. I found, at least written in the history of the traditional dancing in Scotland, those very words, and that meshed right in with our purpose, because what we were doing was trying to gain the attention of groups of people and teach the young people something about themselves and to be proud. And believe me, it accomplished it. I've had kids say to me, well, I can remember after the Beckley Area Heritage Weekend, when we were trying to get this national funding for a couple of years, one young lady wrote to us from Mercer County, Frank's home county, and she said, although it snowed the whole weekend, it was the sunniest days of my life. And then after three or four other counties I worked in, I moved back home to work because my mother is elderly and somebody needed to be there. And the last in Roane County, which is the lower altitude Ohio River part, one young lady said to me not more than a year ago, when I knew her mother and her father, I didn't know her. And she said, oh, I know you. I went to the first Mountain Heritage Weekend for Parkersburg area kids. And that weekend changed my life.
So in a way, you've been able to pick up where the tradition may have skipped, and even though they didn't get it from their parents, they were able to get what was theirs again.
Well, that was what we tried to do. We tried to bridge some gaps from the present, wherever they lived and whoever they were, back, and give them some interest. And of course, everybody's skills are not the same, so, well, you know, some of them, as I said, became craftsmen, some became dancers, some became vocal musicians. Many, many of them did that. And many, many of them have made their way to our door to learn about how to hold a fiddle and how to, the basic skills. Mm-hmm. Frank's, I've never heard him refuse to anyone to come in and answer their questions and try to show them what they wanted to know. Mm-hmm. Now, there wasn't that many pipers, and there still isn't, and there isn't any classical, so-called competitive Highland dancing going on that I know of. But we did have these dancing groups in every county I worked in. He accompanied them and I taught them. And we got the steps and we got the rhythm. And we tried to teach them or get them interested in their family backgrounds. And they would do that and research those. I'd say, you start with your parents and write down all the grandparents back of that you can think of the names, and we'll find if you connect with any clan or not. And if you do, instead of wearing costumes all alike, I want you to wear your own. And you'd be surprised what some of them have done with that as an interest.
How did you learn Highland dancing? Did you know it before you decided to want to teach it, or?
Not at all. The first demonstration Heritage Weekend we had, I got this idea that we needed to do that. I don't know why. Maybe it was probably because, as Frank said, nobody was doing any of this till I put on a kilt and started walking around. And we got Sue Lang, who was a young teacher from Pittsburgh, to come down and spend the weekend with us and show it to us and try to get us started. You know, you can't learn it in 2 days, Saturday and Sunday, Friday night and Saturday and Sunday. But at least we learned the first step of the Highland Fling or something. And then I picked out a group of people in the county I was working in who were very interested and were going to go with me on it. And we had Sue come down for a week, and we put in an intensive week of training during their Easter break. And from then on, we had a Highland dance group. And I learned with them, because I didn't know it. And then I found out, we began to find out that there was, I believe that if a kid can do one dance, country dance or classical Highland or whatever, you put him in performance as soon as you can, quickly. And because his motivation is high then, and he's proud and pleased. So we didn't look for perfection, but we did try to develop the kids. And we did a lot of exhibitions locally and as far away as Atlantic City, National Folk Festival in Knoxville 1 year, and we traveled all over the place. And then what happened really was that people began to come up to us and say, I used to be a champion Highland dancer. The first one that said that was a woman from Huntington who I said, come and teach us. And then, you know, I got help in these kinds of ways. We even organized a group that went to Europe on a tour of young people. That was when I worked in Frank's home county of Mercer.
And you've both been to, have you been to Scotland?
Oh, yeah.
Been there four
years. We've been there 3 times together, and Frank was there.
First trip was courtesy of Uncle Sam.
With the Army?
Yeah. We organized a pipe band too, Southern Counties Gaelic Pipe Band at one time, but it was only lasted 2 or 3 years.
Some of the outgrowths of that directly. Now, all this happened before there was an Augusta Heritage Workshop, before there was an art and craft fair in the centennial year, but I saw most of what's happened in the folk world and the traditional music and dance and everything in this state develop. And it probably would have anyway, because there was an upsurge of this kind going on all over America, and indeed I found out it's going on all over the world. But I think we were pretty useful in helping people get ideas and get started.
There was Dalton Morris dancing.
Wait a minute.
She taught English dance.
Yeah, we did. We had some good Morris teams. There is one exists right now in Roane County that's the best one of all of my head. Really? They do the rapper sword, and they do it beautifully, and they love to do it. But anyway, you asked me, or Frank wanted me to tell you that we organized, what'd you say? The Southern Counties Pipe Band was in Putnam County when I first met Frank, when we were first married. And there was another really good piper down there that Frank and he taught some young people. And for a brief time, we had what we called the Southern Counties Pipe Band. They were... And Southern Counties Gaelic Pipe Band. And then when we moved to Mercer County, there were a lot of people there interested in it. And we had a young lady from Nova Scotia come down and teach that group. And they really were pretty good dancers in the Scottish tradition there. And that was the first time we had a team in the rapper sword. And of course, we've always had the square dance teams everywhere we've gone. And all of these have become exhibition dance teams that traveled around to civic groups and fairs and festivals and did performances. And we always talked about our heritage. So then we organized among the adults and the older youth what we called a Pan-Celtic Society of Southern West Virginia, and they still meet. What happened was one day we said to one another, we know all these people that are crazy about this part of the culture, but they don't know one another. Let's get them together. And we did. And there were some of them make beautiful knives. Frank wears a knife with his kilt as his Dirk, you know, the big knife, that was made by one of these men. And those families, he has a brother too, he and his brother make them. And so there's just all kinds of things happening. There was a tour to Europe organized, and another one, and that was 1974, another one 1982 that included youth that we had taught and influenced and went with us. And what else? Let me see. There's a major effort being made in West Virginia now. St. Andrew's Society of West Virginia exists. And now that I've retired, I think I'm going to have time to be a part of that a little better. And I'd like to have done it more than I've done, but you can do only so much. And the young people that we have had contact with, there's been some very significant things happen to them, with them.
Are you still dancing yourself at all?
Well, I'm not dancing. I'm not teaching dancing, therefore I'm not dancing as much. I dance a little now and then, but perhaps I've gotten it out of my system. I don't know what it is. I used to be crazy about the crafts. When I worked as a craft specialist, too. In fact, I got Rachel Nash and Candace Laird together when I was connected with the Art and Craft Fair because I was a craft specialist for the state, and we needed to enroll apprentices and get some of these crafts going. And of course, you know, you probably have interviewed Rachel, and you know how far she's gone with that.
I have.
With basketry. Well, that's just another example. And there's so many things. One thing, delightful thing that happened in 1978 late and 79 was the formation of the Clan Erdvickle. And those are a bunch of young people in Monroe County who play music, and they play in the Kaylee style. They wear kilts. They went with us to Scotland, or part of them did, in 1982 to Ireland and Scotland and Wales. And Frank has said to me that his ambition was to have a Kaylee band, and they aren't his. They actually went to work and formed the band, and Dennis White, who is an adult that is a managing member of the band, deserves credit for that, and yet we laid the foundation while we were there. They were all members of dance groups, and they learned the tunes, danced to them, and then some of them took lessons from Frank while we were there. Dennis White did every week. So, and I don't dance much anymore. I don't do many crafts anymore because I did so many for so long. I did so much dancing for so long that I don't want to do a lot of that anymore.
I've never wanted to learn the pipes.
Yeah, I wish I could play an instrument, but I think it's too late to start to be a piper. I like all the music, and I would like to, I'm especially fond of the Tin Whistle. I'd like to play it. I probably could if I'd concentrate on it. There's one thing. Frank's always been very, very interested in ammunition and guns. He's quite an authority on that, although most people don't know that. You could interview him on that all day. People come every week to our house and say to him, what is this, or what kind of ammunition do I need for this?
Right.
And he's particularly interested in the history of firearms because it goes so much along with the history of whatever country they happen to come from and things like that. And my ambition is to outshoot him on one target sometime. And I have never had time to do much of that, but I do have now, maybe.
Yeah, great. Well, thanks, Jane. I really appreciate your time.